This is the first day of this July 2014 7-day session, and I'm going to be reading for these first few days of the session, reading from the teachings of the 17th century Japanese Zen master Bankei. And saw from my notes that it's been about 2.5 years since I've read from this. And he is was a remarkable Zen master from the medieval times. I'll start off today reading about his life before tomorrow getting into his teachings. He was born in 1622, and just to give some reference, I like to do this. I don't know if anyone else appreciates it, but it can help us see that these masters weren't just remote, otherworldly people out of time, like some other realm. But that there was a lot going on in the world during Bankei's life. This was was the time of the Plymouth Colony here in the United States, the Puritans and the Quakers, the Dutch colony of New Amsterdam was founded, which is now New York City. Boston and Harvard were established. Mount Vesuvius erupted. There was the terrible persecution of Christianity in Japan and of the Native Americans in the United States. The Dalai Lama's great palace, the Potala, was being built. In Berlin, Germany, was the beginning of Unter den Linden. And this was also in Europe, the time of Descartes, Galileo, Hobbes, and Isaac Newton. And last but not least, the first coffee shop opens in London. Which I'm guessing some of you would like to have some coffee right now. So he's born in 1622. Japan had just recently emerged from a long period of civil war. It was basically a military dictatorship. Oh, excuse me, I'm reading from the introduction now of a book called Bankei Zen by Peter Haskell. And the text, the main text that we'll get to tomorrow, are translations from the Record of Bankei. The sort of official biographies of the masters are often called the record of Joshu, the record of Rinzai, the record of Bankei. And this is from the introduction where the author, Peter Haskell, is just sort of sketching out the context at the time. Although many of the temples had prospered during the years of civil war, the teaching of Zen itself had seriously declined. During the 15th and 16th centuries, Zen practice had degenerated into a type of secret oral transmission strongly influenced by esoteric Buddhism, and the result was a formalized and lifeless affair in which the experience of enlightenment had little or no part. The situation was the same in both the Rinzai and Soto sects. And then a reaction set in during the Bankei 17th century, but there was no general agreement on the best way to revive Zen in a new age. Bakke was born in a seaside port. His father was a Confucian, a Ronin, or a masterless samurai from the island of Shikoku. Bakke's father was adopted into a local family where he became a doctor, which was a popular occupation among former samurai. Interesting connection there. Bakke was the third of three sons, and when his father died, the oldest of the three, Tadayasu, became head of the household. Bakke was always close to his mother and remained devoted to her throughout his life, but by all accounts, he and his older brother were temperamental opposites. This oldest brother, Tadayasu, was a Confucian, a stern moralist with a conviction of the importance of serious study and obedience. By contrast, the young Bakke tended to be wild, unruly, and defiant, a ringleader in any mischief and the village champion at rock fighting. The inevitable confrontation occurred when Bakke was about 11. He was sent for lessons at the neighborhood school. And he rebelled against the lifeless character of the standard curriculum, which was the Confucian classics, especially memorizing a classic called The Great Learning. And it says, as Bakke tells us in the sermons, his curiosity was aroused by the opening words of the text. And these were those opening words: the way of the great learning lies in illuminating bright virtue. Now, this proved to be pivotal in Bakke's spiritual development, this line, these words. Now, there's a footnote here about this. It says the complete passage reads, "The way of the great learning lies in illuminating bright virtue, in loving the people and abiding in the highest good." Classic Confucian ideas. And then the author here in his introduction continues to say that bright virtue is one of the key concepts of the great learning. It was often interpreted as a kind of dynamic, intuitive moral sense that constitutes intrinsic nature. I'm going to turn for just a moment to a book by the late Robert Aitken Roshi in which he talks about this term. The Chinese term used here is a compound that means noble virtue. So that's another translation. Bright virtue is one translation. Noble virtue is another one. But virtue, he says, is the key element. He says this is one of the keys to Asian culture and indeed to human culture. It is the De of the Tao Te Ching, the central text of Taoism. He says, take power, the words power and virtue together, and you have an approximation of the meaning of this bright virtue or noble virtue. Uh, It is this unusual definition of virtue, unusual to us as Westerners, is actually part of a definition in a dictionary where the third meaning of virtue in the dictionary I consulted is effective power or force, efficacy, potency. So it's not, obviously, it's not just the opposite of badness. Really, we can just substitute essential nature or true nature. Back to our text, the author says it's likely that Bankei received some such explanation on questioning the local Confucian scholars. But when he pressed them about it, no one actually seemed to know what bright virtue was, and Bankei was left to puzzle out the problem for himself. He was disappointed and he was consumed by doubts, and he eventually began to avoid his classes. His older brother was outraged at Bankei's refusal to continue his studies, and life at home became increasingly unpleasant. Bankei had no intention of returning to the village school, and seeing no way out of his predicament, he reportedly concealed himself in the graveyard of the family temple and attempted suicide by swallowing a mouthful of poisonous spiders. The next day, he found himself still very much alive and faced with the same unwelcome prospects at home. Well, tensions between Bankei and his older brother continued to worsen, and finally, his older brother expelled the young truant from the household. But Bankei continued to be obsessed by this notion of bright virtue. And his search finally led him to the Dharma. When he was 13, Bankei had begun to study with the priest at the family temple. The following year, his father's old friend constructed a small retreat for Bankei on the mountain behind the family home. Bankei practiced alone there for a while. This was when he was 14 years old, sitting alone in a little retreat. But he continued to be consumed by doubts, and that drove him to find a teacher. For a while, he studied esoteric Buddhism. It's a different sect of Buddhism. But then his search brought him to the Myo Shinji line and Zen master Unpo. Myo Shinji is one of the most respected lineages in Rinzai Zen. So he found this master Unpo. And now I'm going to switch, and I'll do this a couple more times this morning. I'm going to switch to another book on Bankei called The Unborn, The Life and Teaching of Zen Master Bankei. And this one is translated by Norman Waddell. And I'm switching because Waddell presents some of this in Bankei's own words. The Waddell's words. Unpo was 70 years old when Bankei visited him, and he had earned a wide reputation as a stern taskmaster who whom demanded total dedication from his monks. Right off, Bankei told Umpo of the difficulty he was having in trying to come to terms with bright virtue. Umpo replied that if he wanted to discover what it meant, he would have to practice Zazen. There it is. No explanations, just sitting. Bankei asked Umpo to ordain him as a Buddhist monk. Umpo immediately shaved Bankei's head. Waddell continues, although we have no specific information about the way in which Umpo instructed Bankei, we can reasonably assume that Bankei was subjected to a demanding training program during the 3 years he was under Umpo's guidance. Zazen was, of course, the chief ingredient of training. Bankei probably did some work on koans as well, although no clear evidence reveals this, and there is some indication that Umpo may not have laid the same stress on koans that his contemporaries did. A footnote here. Let's see if I want to read it. Nothing worth reading. So after 3 years with Umpo, Bankei left him back to the first text, Peter Haskell. Although Bankei was always grateful for Umpo's kindness, notice kindness, severe training, he recognized his kindness. Bankei does not appear to have held a high opinion of Umpo's abilities as a Zen master. Bankei was now 19, and he left on a four-year pilgrimage. Once he took leave of Umpo, he had no fixed residence. He stayed in temples, but more often he lived a solitary life in rude, self-made huts. Or frequently, to judge from his records, he merely slept in the open. He is reported to have lived among beggars for several years. And the following is his own words. I pressed myself without mercy, draining myself mentally and physically. At times I practiced deep in the mountains, in places completely cut off from all human contact. I fashioned primitive shelters out of paper, pulled that over me, and did Zazen seated inside. Sometimes I would make a small lean-to by putting up two walls of thick paper boards and sit in solitary darkness inside, doing Zazen, never lying down to rest even for a moment. Whenever I heard of some teacher whom I thought might be able to give me advice, I went immediately to visit him. I lived that way for several years. There were few places in the country I did not set foot. So after those 4 years of very demanding, mostly individual retreats. He went back to Umpo. But there too, he withdrew to a hut nearby and continued his regimen of strenuous sitting. For 2 years now, Bankei subjected himself to a series of grueling ordeals in a desperate effort to resolve his doubts once and for all. And now we're going back to Bankei's own words. Just first, before his own words, he isolated himself completely from contact with the outside, walling himself up within his tiny dwelling. He sat constantly, day and night, dedicating himself with even greater urgency to Zazen. Eventually, his buttocks and thighs became inflamed and swollen from constant contact with the bare rock floor. They began to fester, but still he kept sitting. He gave up eating for weeks at a time. He threw cold water over himself whenever he felt even the slightest approach of the demons of sleep. That's a phrase that Hakuin also used, the demon of sleep. And here are Bankei's words describing this retreat. The room was about 10 feet square and resembled nothing as much as a prison cell. There was only one small opening, just large enough for an arm to pass through. Sorry, these aren't his words, but they come from his words. The door he plastered shut with mud so that no one could enter to bother him. Food was passed to him through the hole in the wall twice each day. After he had finished eating it, he placed the bowl outside the opening once again. A privy was arranged just below the wall so that he could relieve himself from inside the room through a small aperture made for that purpose. As far as food being passed to him, this would be considered quite common for someone of his great efforts to have found a patron of sorts who would deliver food to him twice a day. It says, but the long years of struggle had weakened him both physically and mentally. He contracted tuberculosis. And now these are his words. My utter neglect of health and the years of physical punishment finally took its toll and came to a head in a serious illness. My condition steadily worsened. I grew weaker and weaker by the day. Whenever I spat gouts of bloody sputum as big as thumb heads appeared. Once I spat against a wall and the globules stuck and slid to the ground in bright red beads. The illness reached a critical stage. For a whole week I was unable to swallow anything except some thin rice broth. And then now the author again, Waddell. The physician who examined him is reported to have, quote, thrown aside his medicine spoon. Bankei was past the point where such remedies could be of help. He was now resigned to dying. But with things at their darkest, his dramatic personal struggle to attain enlightenment came to an end. And these are Bankei's words. I felt a strange sensation in my throat. I spat against a wall. A mass of black phlegm, large as a soapberry, rolled down the side. Suddenly, just at that instant, I realized what it was that had escaped me until now. All things are perfectly resolved in the unborn. After 14 years of incredible hardship, he had achieved a decisive enlightenment, his doubts and uncertainties disappearing like a dream. Immediately he felt his strength begin to return, his appetite improved almost miraculously, and with it, his health. It's accounts like these, like this one, that reminds us of the intimate connection between body and mind. That once he had experienced this great release through deep enlightenment, then everything cleared up. His health returned to normal. There's a verse in the Mumon Kan where Mumon says, rather than giving relief to the body, give relief to the mind. This is really what this is, what this means. You hear about people all the time who get obsessed with diet and a lot of other things, exercise, and there's nothing wrong with it. Certainly, we have to attend to those things. But we hear the other side here is just resolving this great matter of life and death and how completely restorative and healing that can be. Soon after this, according to the accounts given in two of the biographical records, another enlightenment occurred. This one was triggered when the fragrant smell of plum blossoms was borne to him on the morning breeze as he was washing his face in a nearby stream. One of these versions links this second experience to the first one in the following way. The master, frustrated in all his attempts to resolve the feeling of doubt which weighed so heavily on his mind, became deeply disheartened. Signs of serious illness appeared. He began to cough up. This is what we already heard. He said to himself, everyone has to die. I'm not concerned about that. My regret is dying with the great matter I've been struggling with all these years, still unresolved. His eyes flushed with hot tears. His chest heaved violently. It seemed his ribs would burst. Just at that moment, enlightenment came to him like the bottom falling out of a bucket. Immediately, his health began to return, but still he seemed unable to express what he had realized. Then one day, in the early hours of the morning, the scent of plum blossoms carried to him in the morning air reached his nostrils. At that instant, all attachments and obstacles were swept from his mind once and for all. The doubts that had been plaguing him ceased to exist. And we see from the previous text of called Bankei Zen that he almost never mentioned bright virtue again. When he was 29, he heard of the arrival of a Chinese master, Dao Zhe. Dao Zhe spoke no Japanese, but he sized up Bankei immediately and informed him that his enlightenment, while genuine, was not yet complete. So Bankei decided to join Dao Che's monastery, and one evening experienced his second enlightenment while sitting in a darkened corner of the monastery Zendo. He presented his realization to the master, and he said to Dao Che, "What about the matter of birth and death?" And Dao Che wrote, "Whose birth and death is this?" Since Dao Che was Chinese and Bankei was Japanese, and neither spoke the other's language, they had to communicate through written language, through characters. This was just a necessity in that transition of Zen from China to Japan. So Dao Che wrote with his brush and ink, "Whose birth and death is this?" Bankei extended both hands. And now Dao Che took up his brush again, but this time Bankei snatched it away and hurled it to the ground. The following day, Dao Che publicly announced that Bankei had completed his practice of Zen, and he made him the head cook. Bankei stayed with Dao Che for about a year, received his Dharma transmission. It says, in retrospect, he recognized Dao Che's limitations and lamented that with no enlightened masters available, Dao Che was the best he could do under the circumstances. And then there's a lot of politics here in this introduction that we have to skip. Politics, I mean within the Zen school of different masters and lineages. And now Bankei's fame began to spread. He acquired numerous followers among the upper ranks of the samurai who vied for his visits and offered temples in their domains and in the capitals of Kyoto and Edo. The following years found Bankei frequently in seclusion at one or another of the cloisters provided by his benefactors, practicing alone, instructing a select group of disciples, or nursing his recurrent illness. Bankei's early struggles had taken a severe toll on his health, and in later life he was often in extreme discomfort, afflicted with chronic stomach spasms and fits of coughing that required intervals of quiet convalescence. So notice, after two or three major enlightenments, Bankei still would sit day and night alone in his hermitages. But then at age 57, Bankei started to feel called to group practice, sitting with the other monks and giving public discourses. And he began traveling to various temples and sometimes delivering as many as three talks a day. The author says, unfortunately, we know little of the actual details of practice at Bankei's temples. Bankei would not tolerate repressive behavior, such as the beating or scolding that still characterizes training at many Zen temples. Nor would he allow begging by his monks. Begging meaning the ritualized, what we call takahatsu, where the monks would go on rounds and collect rice or sometimes money from devoted followers who wanted to support the monks. Bankei's later years were marked by constant travel between his various temples and patrons. In 1680, that's when he was 58, he suffered a severe loss with the death of his mother, who had become a Buddhist nun and retired to a convent not far from Bankei's temple. Bankei had always been fiercely devoted to his mother and insisted that what had originally driven him to realize enlightenment had been, above all, his desire to communicate the truth to her. Now Bankei was at the height of his career. His teaching of the unborn had won a vast and devoted following. And in addition to the numerous honors he had achieved, the emperor now awarded him the personal title Zen Master of Beneficent Enlightened Wisdom. Later that year, he conducted the most famous of his training periods, a vast 3-month training period at Ryomonji, attended by nearly 1,700 monks of every sect. Available space in the Ryomonji Zendo was quickly exhausted, and temporary Zendo had to be improvised. The Kessei, this 3-month retreat, was funded and provisioned by the Sasaki brothers. You know, the Sasaki brothers. But the crowd of monks grew so immense that the Sasakis panicked and vainly begged Bankei to turn away any further applicants. Vainly. It's not easy for teachers to turn away anyone who has the commitment and the seriousness of purpose to come to a sesshin or an extended meditation. At this, Bankei delivered a total of 60 teisho, which were recorded by members of the audience, and that these teisho make up the bulk of this book that we'll be getting back to tomorrow. Bankei's health had worsened. He was 71 now. And he became seriously ill. He managed to deliver a final 3 days of teishos, but his condition continued to worsen and then he died. Well, I had to skip some segments of this so that we didn't take any more than one teisho on it. But our time is up now. We'll stop and recite the four vows.